Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting Bookshelf this week on the East County Magazine radio show. Today, I am speaking with our special guest, true crime author Caitlin Rother, about her new book, Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion Case. My guest, who spent 20 years as a Pulitzer-nominated investigative journalist, is also a TV crime commentator. She has authored or co-authored 14 books, several Kindle ebooks, and contributed to a COVID-19 anthology. This new book is a true crime narrative about the case of Rebecca Zahau, whose death in 2011 gripped our city and country for an entire decade. Welcome, Caitlin. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me back.
Our pleasure. Well, let's start by talking about Rebecca's death at the Spreckles Mansion 10 years ago. In your view, Caitlin, how has the story of what happened to her become such a compelling mystery?
Well, to start with, the condition that her body was found in was very bizarre and very unusual. When women typically commit suicide, if that's what this was, they tend to do it in a nonviolent way. So they'll take pills and go to sleep. They don't generally hang themselves. And this is the only case that anybody involved in this case had ever heard of where a woman was hanging naked. On top of that, Rebecca was also had her hands bound behind her back and her ankles bound together. And on top of that, as if that wasn't enough, she was hanging outside, which is also very, you know, just unheard of. And she had a gag in her mouth. So there's a t-shirt that was wrapped around her head on top of the hanging rope, which was on top of her hair.
So it defies logic.
Yeah. So the state of her body is one thing. Then, you know, it happens in a historic landmark, the Spreckles Mansion, which was built in 1908 by John D. Spreckles, who was the richest man in the county, and his family was the richest in the state of California. So that's unusual. Rebecca was also involved with a very rich man as well in real time, Jonas Shacknai, who owned a pharmaceutical corporation at the time. And then on top of that, you have Jonah's brother who came to stay at the guest house, who is a tugboat captain from Memphis. So, and he's pretty eccentric. So you've got this cast of characters, you've got a historic landmark, and you've got this very unusual death.
Yeah, Agatha Christie couldn't have set it up any better. Well, Caitlin, that's all very fascinating. Can we talk about some of the unanswered questions and holes in this suicide theory, as well as the murder theories that have been put forward? And the sheriff, by the way, for the record, did find that it was a suicide, correct?
Yes.
Tell us what was not addressed by the sheriff's investigation. You know, what are some of the evidence and collection methods that outside observers have criticized?
So, as you said, the sheriff's department ruled Rebecca's death a suicide. They had a short investigation of about 7 weeks. And some people think that that was rushed. Some people questioned the validity of that because, as we just discussed, this is so unusual and so bizarre, you know, that the sheriff's department didn't really do itself any favors by keeping so many details and, you know, much of what their rationale was for this finding. And they said, well, we're trying to protect the Zahau family and, you know, their privacy, and we don't want to re-traumatize this family. But, you know, a lot of people just didn't buy this, including the Zahaus. Well, so the Zahaus think that, you know, she was murdered. They just don't buy this. And so a lot of questions have been raised because, you know, and I'm not taking a position in this case. So I don't believe that it's clear either way, whether it's a suicide or a murder, because of these questions. So starting with the suicide, if it was a suicide, why wasn't she decapitated, or at least partially decapitated? The injuries in her neck are fractured cartilages. Now, if you're going to drop over a railing by 9 feet, you know, the experts testified at the civil trial where the jury found Adam Shacknai responsible for Rebecca's death. The Zahow's experts testified, a couple of them, that the injuries in her neck just did not match the story of how she died.
Would they have matched if it had been a murder? How would that have happened?
Well, according to these experts, the injuries in her neck were more consistent with being strangled and then having somebody lower her over the edge, because usually when somebody's, this is called a long fall drop or a long drop. Normally when somebody hangs themselves, it's over a door, or you step off a chair, you fall 1 or 2 feet. So
you don't fling yourself over a railing and just leave a paw print.
Right. So that's number one. Number two, there's some imprints on the balcony floor. There's dust and dirt, and there were some marks that the sheriff's crime lab criminalists said were toe prints. Well, there are different experts on the outside who've looked at those toe prints. And one expert says, well, I actually see another set of prints on top of her prints.
Oh.
And there's only one little toe or one big toe, one print near the railing. How is she going to, 110 pounds, how is she going to throw herself over the railing by leveraging all her weight on one toe with her hands behind her back and her ankles bound? So how did she learn how to tie those elaborate knots that were around her wrists and her ankles? And the sheriff's department says, well, it was very easy. We have this female deputy. We're going to show you how it could have been done. But the Zahow's knot tying expert during the trial said, those are not the same knots. Those were way too simple. They were not tied the same way. These are the knots that I saw on her body. And he did this elaborate demonstration on a mannequin in the courtroom, which was just, I was boggled at how complicated those knots were. So, there's evidence, and then there are interpretations of the evidence. And the sheriff's department's investigation, a lot of people feel, just did not satisfy them. Why would she even kill herself that way? Now, by the same token, on the murder side, the sheriff say, why would someone kill her that way? Why would they draw so much attention to this death? Why not just put a gun in her hand and make it look like she shot herself? Why is there no DNA or fingerprints at the scene other than Rebecca's? If someone killed her, why isn't there, some evidence that a killer was there? But does the house claim that the scene was wiped down, that the killer wore gloves? Because there was a knife that Adam even admitted to using to cut her down, and his DNA wasn't on that knife either. So there are these Adam was the brother. The contrary facts of the matter don't even match up.
No, now there was a really bizarre note that was scrawled on the door, on the wall. Mm-hmm. Refresh our memories about what that said, and what's your take on that?
So there was a message on the bedroom door where the hanging rope for the bed that Rebecca's hanging rope was anchored. And on the door, it was in black paint in big block letters. It said, she saved him, can you save her? Now, there are actually two deaths in this story. And so this is important. So within 48 hours before Rebecca's body was found by Adam Shacknai, who called 911 and said, I got a girl, hung herself in the guest house, even though he later said he was the one in the guest house, that she was in the main house. There was a little boy, Max, who was 6 years old, and he had a tragic fall two mornings earlier. Jonah's son with his second wife, Dina Shacknai. And Rebecca claimed that she was downstairs in the bathroom when she heard this loud crash and a dog barking, her dog. She came out. She said she found this little boy lying on the floor, not breathing. His heart wasn't beating. There was a broken glass chandelier lying next to him, broken glass all over the floor, which had previously been above them on the second floor ceiling, and a soccer ball and a razor scooter. So her little sister was there, 13-year-old sister who was visiting, and she asked her sister to call 911. In the meantime, she told Jonah that she gave Max some breaths to start CPR. by the time the paramedics came, the doctors finally brought him back at the hospital, he'd been down for 25 or 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. But what most people believe that that note refers to is that she saved him, meaning she tried to give him CPR and was able to bring him back at least, you know. So he was hooked up to machines though. And he wasn't dead when she was found dead. He was declared brain dead a couple days after that. But that's what the first part of the message appears to be referring to. Now, the second part of the message, can you save her? That's the part people really want to argue about, because if it's a suicide note, why is it written in the third person? Why is it written in this angry, taunting tone?
Yeah.
Why is why are the paint marks, you know, the letters are written, you know, it's not pretty. It's not like it's calligraphy. It looks kind of
so
angry.
You're saying it doesn't look like her handwriting? Was there an analysis done?
There was an analysis done by the Zuhauz expert, who the defense spent almost an entire day in a hearing outside of the jury's presence to try to keep him out. And then they did a very, very long cross-examination trying to put holes in this in his statements, which basically said that it was more likely Adam's handwriting, painting these letters than it was Rebecca, which is a pretty low standard because it's civil court.
Yeah.
Because he said the A's and the M's look more like his letters. Now, Adam signs his name in capital letters, just coincidentally.
The plot thickens. So I understand they didn't collect Adam's phone or phone records to even back up his story about where he said he was and when. What was his alibi, and why do you think the sheriff was, what sounds like, frankly, sloppy in not collecting those basic records?
Well, there are a number of outside experts, and they've pretty much all said, why didn't the sheriff's department collect Adam's phone? I mean, it seems like kind of an obvious thing to do, and I honestly don't know why they didn't do it. I asked him that myself. I never got a good answer.
Yeah.
They did get Jonah's phone records. They did get Rebecca's phone records. They were able to see that Jonah called Rebecca and left her a voicemail at 12:50 a.m. the morning that she was found. So Adam found her and called 911 at 6:48 a.m. Hmm. And Jonah says he left her a voicemail and he was crying on the phone and basically said, reporting what the doctor had told him and Max's mother, that Max, the best scenario was that Max would never walk or talk again. And Jonah told me, I interviewed him 8 times by Skype for a couple hours each time, right after I thought I had finished writing the entire book. I had to redo a whole bunch of it because I got him finally. I thought he was very important and to have his perspective in the book. But he told me that he really wished that he hadn't left her that message. He wished that he had just said, call me back, because he feels like that contributed. And that's what the sheriff said. The sheriff said that the reason they're saying it was suicide is because she was distressed and troubled and felt guilty about what had happened to Max, because she was the only adult in the house at the time. And that she felt guilty. Now, there's a house say she never said that. She'd never, you know, threatened to commit suicide before. She wasn't depressed. The sheriff said, well, yes, she was.
Well,
because there's
back-
some notes on her phone that they were able to get. Unfortunately, they were not able to get that voicemail. So
but she didn't leave a suicide note, to be clear.
Well, I guess the sheriff's department believes that that note on the door is her suicide note,
even though the handwriting didn't seem to match. Very interesting. There was also a polygraph test that Adam took. And I understand the results were somewhat conflicting on that. Tell us about that.
Well, so Adam did take a polygraph, which is a voluntary thing, I believe. I don't think they can make you. And they also don't, it's not usable in court, but it is an investigative tool that investigators, detectives do use. And the results, according to the sheriff's examiner, were inconclusive. However, he determined that Adam was telling the truth.
Based on inconclusive results?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, they look at other things too, body language, maybe, I don't know. But that was his determination. And outside experts said, well, they should have done another test, number one. And number two, when they looked at the results, and, you know, these are you know, they're sine waves or sound waves. I don't know what they look at, but I guess they can see a motion in, you know, in these waves. And they read the test as Adam was being deceptive. So not only was it not, was he not telling the truth, he was being deceptive.
Yeah, very interesting. Can you comment on the DNA evidence? I understand there was some questions about the methodology that was used for collecting that.
Well, according to the Zuhauz expert, the DNA expert that they had testify during the trial, there were at least 12 places where she thought there should have been DNA, that there wasn't any DNA. And that's why the Zuhauz attorney, Keith Greer, said he felt that the area had been wiped down. Now, the defense and the sheriff's department say, well, you can't selectively wipe away DNA from one person and not from another.
But if it was suicide, why would she have wiped down the DNA? And she certainly couldn't have done that after she was dead. So it just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Well, the point is her DNA was there. So they're not saying Rebecca would have wiped it down or not wiped it down, but Rebecca's DNA was there and her fingerprints were there. And the sheriff's department is saying, you can't selectively choose whose DNA you're going to wipe away. If somebody had wiped it away, her DNA would be gone too.
I see. So that would sort of argue more toward the suicide theory and not the murder theory. Interesting. There are a lot of unanswered questions here regarding the sheriff's investigation of Rebecca's death and how it occurred at the home of her billionaire boyfriend. Caitlin, what part did power and corruption play, if any, in this whole scenario, according to what you have learned over the years?
Well, one thing that Jonah and I kind of laughed about was that he has become a billionaire in this case, when in fact, he's actually only a millionaire. There's a lot of people have called him a billionaire, but he's actually, it's okay. A lot of it's been on the news wrong too. So he owned a pharmaceutical corporation, Medicis, and news of this peculiar, bizarre, and elaborate death apparently affected his stock prices. And he was very concerned about his business, and he told the detectives that. So in one of the, he did two interviews with the detectives, and you can even hear it on the tape where he says, look, can you just publicly state that I'm not a suspect? Because this is really hurting my business and, you know, et cetera. So people have said, well, Jonah's really rich. This death doesn't make sense as a suicide to us. So we think that, you know, Jonah's wealth must have had undue influence. And in fact, one of the Zuhauz early attorneys made that statement on TV and ended up getting a cease and desist order from Jonah's attorney. So he has vehemently denied this. The Zuhauz believe, though, that the sheriff shared information with Jonah that he didn't share with them. Mm-hmm. They believe there was some sort of, you know, favorable treatment. They've believed that there's racial discrimination, that they didn't really see Rebecca for who she really was. And they painted her as this terrible person and sick person and crazy person. And so they have alleged that also that it seems so clear to them that even the civil judge in one of her last rulings said, you know, that the sheriff's investigation left as many questions unanswered as it answered, and that it's perfectly fair and reasonable to question who killed Rebecca Zuhauz. So the Zuhauz are saying, well, if even this judge believes that there was enough evidence here to uphold this jury verdict that Adam Shacknai was responsible for Rebecca's death, there's got to be something to this. They want this case reopened and the criminal case reopened. But as of today, there is not enough forensic evidence to meet the criminal threshold. Right. So they have sued the sheriff's department recently, last year. So there's like another civil suit pending, this time against the sheriff's department, though. So the first one was against Adam Shacknai and originally against Dina Shacknai, the Max's mother and her sister. They were ultimately dismissed. So today it's now against the sheriff's department, and they're trying to get records to try to get more evidence that the sheriff's department either was, you know, holding things back or had some kind of ulterior motive, that they did things wrong during the investigation, because they're just trying to do anything they can to get this thing reopened.
Yeah, which is understandable. We should jump in and note here that Sheriff Gore has gone on record, I understand, denying that he accepted any
yes,
bribes
absolutely.
Or any undue influence. Right. You've said there were no campaign contributions that you could
right.
document.
Right. So I went and looked at the campaign donations, because if you remember Strippergate with the San Diego City Councilman, oh, yeah. I covered that too when I was at the paper. Michael Zucchett was acquitted for this, but Ralph Enzinza went to prison. And this was because they accepted campaign donations for, you know, alleged quid pro quo, doing favors or whatever. So this is, you know, illegal. However, there are no campaign donations on Sheriff Scorer's statements. And he said, you know, he was highly offended. He's never done anything wrong. And he told me that he thought that Jonah was actually, you know, the biggest victim in this case, because he lost his son and he lost his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And so
he was double victimized in a sense. I mean, you do feel sorry for him, millions and all. He still, mm-hmm. that's a terrible loss for anybody to.
So they both deny that. They both deny that there was any favorable treatment, special treatment, or any kind of collusion or corruption, whatever.
Yeah. So if there may have been concerns about Jonah perhaps suing over, you know, lost value to his business or his stocks, it's kind of ironic that now the sheriff is being sued not by Jonah, but by the Zahau family for perhaps rushing the
investigation. That's an excellent point.
Interesting. Now, Caitlin, in some ways, it must have been exceptionally difficult for you to write this. You've certainly covered many other true crime stories in the past, but in the book, you explain your own painful insight into the topic of suicide. How did your personal experience losing your husband to suicide impact your writing and your investigation in this case?
Well, I was drawn to this case, obviously, like everyone else, because of the bizarre circumstances of Rebecca's death and the fact that it, you know, was at this house and had these eccentric characters and these rich people and so much sympathy for the Zahau family as well. So I always am drawn to these stories that have such high emotions, that have such inherent conflict in them. But I was also drawn to this case because my husband hung himself. And I know that as a fact. The Zahau family, was taken by surprise and said this absolutely positively could never have happened. My husband threatened to commit suicide repeatedly, and he did it as a manipulative tactic to get me to give him more attention and what have you. I, you know, Rebecca never threatened that. She never talked about being depressed. My husband was diagnosed as being depressed. My husband was actually diagnosed as being borderline personality disorder. However, as I got into this story, I started seeing some parallels in their behaviors, and I'm not trying to diagnose Rebecca as having the same disorder, but I, like I said, I did see some parallels by doing interviews with Michael Berger, who was an old boyfriend of hers. This came out just briefly in court, which is how my curiosity got piqued. Oh, I tracked him down and interviewed him repeatedly. He said that, you know, he was seeing Rebecca, didn't know that she was still married. She told him she was going through a divorce. She wasn't wearing a ring. Mm-hmm. She started, you know, dating him. And, you know, it turns out all these years later, he, you know, didn't realize she never even filed any paperwork.
Oh my.
So she was still married. She was still living with her husband, telling this boyfriend of hers that she was going through a divorce. And then she disappeared one day. They were living together and she disappeared, didn't show up at work. And she started calling him and saying, you know, she's crying. And they took me. He says, who took you? They took me and they're driving me around in a, you know, they've got something over my eyes. And he says, well, where are you? She says, I don't know. I don't know where I am. Huh. Sounds like a bathroom. So it turns out we still don't know exactly what happened, but Michael Berger was convinced that she had been kidnapped because she was crying on the phone. And I said, you know, that sounds an awful lot like something that happened to me. My husband disappeared one night and I couldn't find him. And he came home and he said, the police took me and they, you know, they took my, took me and did a cavity search and did it. And I was just, he was crying and I was just like, wow.
So maybe some kind of psychotic break that they made.
Well, but my point is there's like a pattern of behaviors of telling different stories to different people that Rebecca did. My husband and she both were arrested for shoplifting in Phoenix, not at the same time. They both went through the same diversion program. So, you know, she wasn't an addictive personality. She didn't have that, but she did have some depression. She left these notes on her phone that showed she couldn't sleep. She wasn't eating. She was very upset at Jonah. Their relationship was in trouble. He didn't want to have children. She did. So, you know, I think there's a lot more to this story than we really know. And I think her family really saw her a certain way. And by doing these interviews with these other people, I was able to bring out a whole other side of Rebecca. And I don't think I would have known any of that or seen that without having happened to me what happened to me. And I was able to discuss these behaviors that I saw in my husband with Jonah and with Michael Berger, and not to paint Rebecca as a, you know, bad person, but there, I think she was a troubled person. And I think that, you know, she had a traumatic life too. She had been molested when she was young. Mm-hmm. She was a political refugee. They were very poor. She had food issues. She was obsessed with working out, and she wasn't sleeping. She was upset. So anyway,
well, certainly after the death of the little boy that was in her care at the time, that's certainly understandable. But you're right. One could certainly make a case either way for suicide or murder. And we may never know, you know, the truth in this case. It's just one of those intriguing and tragic mysteries, really. You dedicated your book to Rebecca and Max. Why?
Because I think what gets lost in all of this is, you know, it's a story. It's a debate. People are arguing over this evidence. And I think what gets lost is the fact that we've got two people who are dead. And that is a tragedy, no matter how either one of them died. Rebecca was a loved sister and daughter to her family, and they are still grieving her loss. And Max's family, his parents are still grieving his loss. I don't know that that's ever something that you can get over. And so it's not a parlor game to kind of figure this out. It is a mystery, and it is a big story, but by the same token, I just want to make sure that people don't forget the tragedy and the loss of these two people. And I wanted to pay a tribute to them.
I understand that you have a book signing coming up on May 16th, for those of you that are listening to our Friday show. Can you tell us the details, where people can see you, and if you have any other future events, real or virtual, planned?
Absolutely. The book signing is actually going to be my first and maybe only book signing in person. I didn't know. I had to plan this whole book launch and book tour virtually because of COVID. And thankfully, I was able to get my second shot a couple of weeks ago. So this is actually my first opportunity to do an in-person signing. So we're going to do it outside, though. Be safe. And I'm not going to talk. I'm just going to sign books. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to have a crowd. It's just going to be, you know, one person at a time.
And where is it?
And it's at Bay Books in Coronado from 12 to 2 p.m. Sunday, the May 16th. And then I have a virtual event actually on Saturday, the day before, this Saturday, May 15th. For anybody who wants to join the discussion, I've got an online virtual event with a bookstore in Prescott, Arizona, but it doesn't matter where you are. Right. And the details are on my website. It's caitlinrother.com. If you go to my blog, I've got a virtual tour calendar, and I have other virtual events planned for next week. And I have all the links to all the recorded virtual events I've already done. So if you want to know more, you want to hear more Q&A or read stories or hear me talk about it some more, if this wasn't enough for you, there's more.
Okay. Well, one last question, Caitlin. What are you working on next? And when can we expect to see that?
Well, thanks to COVID, I lost a book contract for a book that I had been working on for a whole year. I was very disappointed. It was on the San Diego Zoo's Frozen Zoo. And I do hope that that will be reinstated at some point when the zoo gets back on its feet financially, because I think it's a fascinating book. But I was really upset about that. And I had to keep myself busy. So I immediately started writing a crime novel. And so I wrote like 120,000 words in a couple months. I mean, I was just went crazy. I'm like, well, I got to do something. I'm locked here in this house. So I have one novel that's out already. I only have one. and it's called Naked Addiction. It's set mm-hmm. in La Jolla and PB. It took me 17 years to get published because it was the first book that I ever wrote. Wow. I had to rewrite mm-hmm. it a lot of times because Good I didn't really know what I know now. After writing 14 books, 11 of them true crime books, I now really know my stuff about homicide investigations and detectives and all that. So this is a sequel to Naked Addiction, and it also takes place in La Jolla, in the La Jolla Farms area, and there are two mysterious deaths. You know, it's about the wealthy. It's about sex and murder and drugs at the beach, just like that's my theme for this series. So, and I'm hoping to have it.
A lot of that in San Diego.
Yeah, hoping it's going to come out later this year. I do have a publisher for it. I just need to make sure that I get it done because this book tour is taking a lot of time and I haven't been able to get back to, I haven't quite finished it yet. I'm still editing it.
I understand you were also working on a book about the McStay case, the family that went missing and was found murdered. What's the status on that?
Well, COVID pretty much sidelined that project. I was able to chip away at it. I did some interviews. It took me months to get a court order to go look at the exhibits and, you know, make copies and stuff. But I just still didn't feel like it was safe to go to the courthouse. And so I've been chipping away at that. But I had hoped to get that further along. But COVID sidelined. That's still on the burner. It's just a slow burner. So, yeah, I am still working on that.
Well, Caitlin, we are out of time for today, but it's been a delight talking with you about your new book, Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion Case. For more information on Caitlin and her books, you can visit her website at caitlinrother.com. That's CaitlinRother.com. Again, this is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting for Raina Menashe on today's East County Magazine's Bookshelf segment, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.